Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 15th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today with the horror in South Florida.
She texted us, and at first we thought it was a hoax, because in today's day and age, you just never know.
At the moment, we have a white male, we're told, wearing a burgundy shirt.
She kept texting me, and she said that she was hiding, that she was fine, but for me to please call 911 because there was somebody hurt.
We heard the police coming down the hallway, banging on doors, and I said, who are you? And he said, the police, and I said, prove it. He showed me their badge, so I opened the door. And I'm not going to open the door for anybody, but, you know, they say they are without proof.
And as more details become available, we'll have a deeper conversation about why these things are happening. But it's a day you pray will never happen, as has happened.
I don't think we could have been more prepared than we were today. I mean, we talked to every single class period that sat in front of us, you know, about what to do in this situation. I mean, they knew what to do, we knew what to do. And even still, even with that, we still have 17, you know, casualties, 17 people that aren't going to return to their families. And to me, that's totally not acceptable.
I thought I was going to die.
You come to the conclusion this is just absolutely pure evil. This state does not tolerate violence. We have law enforcement that will always show up to defend our safety.
This happens nowhere else other than the United States of America. This epidemic of mass slaughter. It only happens here not because of coincidence, not because of bad luck, but as a consequence of our inaction. We are responsible.
At least 17 people are dead after a shooting in a school in Parkland, Florida on Wednesday. 15 others have been injured. The shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School started just before dismissal. The suspect is a former student who had been expelled for disciplinary reasons. Some students describe the shooter as troubled and a social outcast. This is the 18th school shooting this year alone, according to the nonprofit Every Town for Gun Safety, which advocates for gun control. Late this morning, President Donald Trump addressed the nation.
Our entire nation, with one heavy heart, is praying for the victims and their families. To every parent, teacher, and child who is hurting so badly, we are here for you, whatever you need, whatever we can do to ease your pain.
He went on to say that when he meets with governors and state attorneys general later this month, making schools safer will be a top priority.
It is not enough to simply take actions that make us feel like we are making a difference. We must actually make that difference. In times of tragedy, the bonds that sustain us are those of family, faith, community, and country.
The president did not, however, say what those changes might be. David Smiley is covering the shooting for the Miami Herald, and he gave us this update earlier today.
What it seems like is that, you know, though public schools prepare for instances like this quite frequently, they train teachers and administrators on different levels of threats, code black, code red, active shooter, someone on campus. In this instance, because authorities say crews thought to pull the firearm and lure people out of their classrooms, it sounds like schools officials hadn't necessarily planned for something like this, or if they had, they were still in the process of training everybody and preparing schools for such a devious scenario.
And there was a report yesterday, as I was sort of following the news, there were some students who were talking to reporters, and the trauma, you can hear the trauma in their voices, they would break down and cry. How are the students? Have you had a chance to talk to any of the students, the teachers, or any people in the community who are directly dealing with this right now?
I have not personally had a chance to do that. My colleagues were at the school, have been on phones with families and students, and everybody, from what it sounds like, is very shaken up. To some extent, there are students there who feel like they should be more upset, but are still in shock and unable to process the fact that they have friends who have been killed, that a place that is supposed to be a safe space is now going to be somewhere where they can never go back without being traumatized again to some extent. Families who were at a hotel late last night were clearly shaken up and very upset. I think there's just a lot of trying to come to grips with what happened in that sleepy suburban neighborhood. And I think the real grieving is going to begin over the next couple of days as parents have to prepare to bury their children. And everybody comes to grips with the fact that this did happen in their community.
That was David Smiley for the Miami Herald. And now we turn to Jared Moskowitz. He's a Democratic member of the Florida House of Representatives representing the 97th District, which includes Parkland in northern Broward County. And he's also an alumni of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
So I was on the floor of the House. We were in session. We were debating. I don't even remember the bill now that we were debating. And my wife called me hysterical crying that she was unable to pick up our four-year-old from preschool because they were on lockdown. The news started to break. Moments after that, I let the speaker know that I was immediately leaving and I was going back to the district. I went to the airport, flew into Miami, and then landed in the evening and then drove to the district. And I was here with the attorney general and the governor on the ground around 8 o'clock.
Jared, I'm not going to pull any punches here. Americans on either side of the political divide are just sick of hearing these stories. They're sick of seeing students and adults and staff running for their lives. This is becoming a ridiculously sad situation in this country, to say the least. What is your response to this? I mean, people are just, I was even reading tweets from students who were saying, you know what, this is something that they're going to forget about at the end of the day.
The students are right. And we can say Americans are sick of this, but not most Americans, because most Americans keep reelecting people who want to do nothing. I'm not saying we have to do everything. I'm not saying that we have to restrict freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution, but doing nothing, that's what we do. We do nothing. We say that we can pray. But let's be clear, God didn't do this. This is a man-made issue, and it is only to be solved by man.
And we hear a lot of people very frustrated with gun laws. We hear, there were some parents that were on television yesterday who were just saying, you know, you think about this happens in other places and you see it on the news, but when it hits home, it's devastating. Gun laws are one part of the problem. The other narrative that's emerging from this story was that the shooter had a troubled past and that parents and or students should have...
It's the same story. He's got a troubled past. The only thing that changes is the name of the shooter, the name of the victims, and the location of the school or the location of the event. That's the only thing that changes. Everything else is consistent. Our reaction is consistent. Doing nothing is consistent. The one thing we are when it comes to shooting is we are very consistent. We will do nothing.
You know, there is the sense of frustration is palpable. Representative Moskowitz, but what can people actually do? Because I feel like we are at a breaking point emotionally. There are, you know, journalists on air who are, you know, very emotional about this, our ability to just be objective about these stories is almost impossible at this point.
I tell people that all they can do is vote, but I'm not even sure that's enough anymore. Because we've gerrymandered every single solitary House seat in Congress in Washington, D.C., and across state houses in every state in the nation. So as a result, there's no more moderates. There's no more running to the center. It's running to the left and running to the right. It's running to save your own seat, running to save your own hide. And so we did that. We set up these seats so that there would be no competition. There would be no compromise. And now we have the system that we created. And that's why nothing gets done. It isn't just the NRA. It's that we don't have enough people that can talk to each other anymore. Because compromise is a dirty word. Because it means you've given up your principles. And so this is a collective failure.
And you are a parent as well. How do you, as a parent, how do you feel about this?
As a parent, I'm glad my kid is 4 and my other son is 1 so that they don't see this. They won't even know that this happened in their neighborhood until they're much older. But I can tell you, when I was at the hotel yesterday with the victims' families who wanted to know if their child was missing, and they were waiting for hours to find out the news from law enforcement or from the FBI that their kid was either mangled in a hospital or laying on the ground in the school, I never saw parents pray more that their child was mangled in a hospital. People were coming together, different faiths, different backgrounds, ethnicities, economic statuses, praying that they hoped their kid was in a hospital with gunshot wounds. That's the world we live in. That's what people are praying for. It's sickening.
That was Jared Moskowitz. He's a Democratic member of the Florida House of Representatives representing the 97th District, which includes Parkland and Northern Broward County. He's also an alumni of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. After I spoke to Representative Moskowitz, Florida officials held a press conference to address the shooting. Governor Rick Scott outlined several of the actions he's planning to take in response.
Next week in Tallahassee, I'm going to sit down with state leaders. We're going to have a real conversation about two things. How do we make sure when a parent is ready to send their child to school, that in Florida, that parent knows that child is going to be safe? Number two, how do we make sure that individuals with mental illness do not touch a gun?
Rob Runcie, the superintendent of Broward County Public Schools, also spoke and said that students have been clear about the response they want to see.
I will tell you that students have been reaching out to me, reaching out to staff, probably board members and others, saying that now is the time for this country to have a real conversation on sensible gun control laws in this country.
Later this hour, we'll be speaking with a father who lost his 6-year-old daughter in the Newtown shooting of 2012. He'll tell us what he and his wife did in the wake of that tragedy. And parents, we really want to hear from you today. How do the stories about school shootings impact the way you think about your kids' safety when they go to school each day?
My name's Lisa. I'm calling from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Yes, my son has been in essentially active shooter training since Sandy Hook. That is, since second grade, they have had lockdown where they prepare for a shooter like that.
But some on Facebook, like Marshall, said no, he's not worried about safety. Quote, back in the day, they would hire people to stand outside the schools with a gun. You've got to fight fire with fire.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'm a teacher in Broward County, 6 miles from where this happened. And every school, including Douglas, has a resource officer on call at the school at all times with a gun.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Our number again is 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Embattled and defiant South African President Jacob Zuma resigned yesterday after 2 months of pressure for him to step down.
I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect. Even though I disagree with the decision of the leadership.
Zuma, who became president of the African National Congress in 2009, is facing numerous corruption allegations. And he's also been blamed for the country's steep economic decline. South Africa's parliament voted in Cyril Ramaphosa to succeed Zuma as president and was sworn in today. Ramaphosa replaced Zuma as leader of the ruling party back in December, and he had been pushing for Zuma's resignation. Douglas Foster is an associate professor at Northwestern University and author of the book After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So it's been a very exciting 10 days. Can you give us a brief timeline on some of those developments that led up to Zuma's resignation?
Sure. This results after 2 years, really, of mass protests in the streets under the banner Zuma Must Fall, and came to a head when the top leadership of the African National Congress recalled Jacob Zuma from his office, basically forced him to leave the stage for the election of the deputy president today, which just happened in Parliament, Cyril Ramaphosa.
And for our listeners who may not be as familiar with South Africa and its politics, can you tell us a little bit about who Jacob Zuma was and what his relationship was with the ANC?
Sure. He was a longtime member, born and raised in very poor circumstances, a shoeless goat herd, as he likes to say, with no formal education. And he represented the wing of the party, which was the armed wing, Umkhonto'we Sizwe, organized to try to topple the white minority regime by force. So if you think of the first president, Nelson Mandela, as somebody who came out of prison after 27 years, and his successor, Thabo Mbeki, is the part of the leadership that lived abroad all during those late stages of apartheid. Zuma represented the people who went to the bush and worked hard to overthrow the white government by force. So he represented a considerable constituency.
And he became the president of the African National Congress in 2009. How would you describe his tenure?
It's been rocky, to say the least. He was expected to be a one-term president of the party beginning in 2007 and to kind of stabilize things after a serious revolt within the party against his predecessor. But he was already enmeshed in corruption allegations, and those allegations have dogged him throughout his tenure.
Let's talk a little bit about the corruption. There are different types of corruption that I think he's been accused of, correct?
Yeah, some of it is the kind of corruption we'd be familiar with in this country, the sense of family friends, a family business by a president, say, taking over state business and contracts being let to friends and that kind of thing. In addition to that, he's been accused in a formal document by a semi-autonomous public protector of having turned state decisions over to a small family of businessmen, the Gupta brothers. And those charges that go under the mantle of a name called state capture has been the thing that I think has most immediately led to his fall.
And I'm wondering if you could describe the relationship between Cyril Ramaphosa and Zuma.
Cyril Ramaphosa, unlike those other three categories of leaders I mentioned, those who went into exile, those who went to prison, those who went into the bush, was part of the mass democratic movement, resistance to apartheid in South Africa. He was the leader of the mine workers union, but he lost out to Thabo Mbeki in the contest to see who would succeed Nelson Mandela. He was actually Mandela's first choice to succeed him. In a way, there's a kind of a circling back to a decision that was made way back then. He's been in business for quite a long time. He's now one of the richest men in the country. And that's going to make it difficult for him to convince the ANC rank and file that he can speak for the party, which cast itself as the leading edge of the voice of the rural poor and workers.
And regarding the potential criminal charges against Zuma, where does that stand? Will that investigation continue after his resignation?
Boy, that's the big question. And I think that's the test for a relatively new democracy here. Is now former President Jacob Zuma going to be considered above the law? Or will he have to face the music for deals that he made before he became president and in the presidency? There was a raid yesterday on Valentine's Day, the same day that Zuma stepped down from office, on the compound of the Gupta brothers. And I think that is a sign that the party and the government are serious about investigating and prosecuting crimes.
And the reaction so far from South Africans and the country of South Africa on this change?
Yeah, listening to the talk shows last night, the radio call-in shows and the rest, and this morning, an expression of relief that this one step has been taken. I think his decision to stand down relieved people. There was some indication that he might force the vote to a vote of no confidence in parliament, or even challenge the idea that he should be forced to step down before serving out his term. So I think big relief and also a sense that there will be a very short honeymoon for the new president as criminal cases proceed and the business of getting parliament back to the business of the country and away from this really bruising battle over who will be president.
Douglas, thank you for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Douglas Foster is an associate professor at Northwestern University and author of the book After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. About 1.9 million people live in the 141 square mile area of the Gaza Strip. And while conditions in the Strip have been bad for some time, many are warning of a near breaking point. 2 weeks ago, the UN Middle East envoy described a situation that could become a, quote, full collapse of the economy and social services. David Halpfinger, Jerusalem bureau chief for The New York Times, recently traveled to Gaza and says that the situation has become increasingly dire as a result of Israel's decade-long blockade of Gaza, and more importantly, because of a standoff between two groups vying for control, Hamas and Fatah. David Halpfinger joins us via FaceTime from Jerusalem. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In your New York Times piece, you write that there is no money in Gaza. I mean, that's a pretty intense statement. Does that accurately describe the situation for most Palestinians in Gaza today?
So there is cash in the ATMs. There are people spending money here and there, but nobody has enough money, that's for sure. What I found, and the reason why I went, was, you know, Gaza is experiencing a tremendous humanitarian crisis. And it has been for some time. As you know, it's been under blockade by Israel for the 10 years since Hamas took over in a pretty bloody power struggle with the Palestinian Authority. But what's happening in the past 6 months or 9 months is a political stalemate between the two longstanding rival Palestinian factions who actually tried to make peace, but they haven't quite been able to bring that to consummate that. And so it's created this horrible financial Mexican standoff. One of them, is paying money out to its employees and needs revenue to do so. And the other one is getting the revenue and is not sharing it with the first. So you now have like people who would otherwise be middle-class Palestinians, government workers, tens of thousands of them, who either are getting paid a fraction of what they used to get and only every few months instead of every month, or they've been forced into retirement and have had their pay cut by, you know, way more than half. And this is cascading, like dominoes, through what's left of the Gaza economy.
And more broadly, I'm wondering, you mentioned Israel, the blockade, the 10-year blockade, or more than 10 years. Can Israel actually have a role in alleviating some of this?
That's a big debate that's unfurling now in Israeli society. You know, the rest of the world sees Israel as still occupying Gaza, even if it physically has removed its people. Under international law, it's still an occupation. It is responsible for controlling who goes in and out of Gaza along its borders. And so even though they withdrew their own people from Gaza, they have retained really a tight degree of control. And they know that everybody knows that. So if things really deteriorate there, even if they don't lead to war, if things get bad and people start dying of cholera, as many feel that could happen, Israel's going to be held largely responsible.
Could this lead to a potential conflict?
Yeah. As I was interviewing people in Gaza, everybody from officials to medical people to merchants to just ordinary people on the street, they've been through this. You know, they've seen this show before. Things get bad and wars get precipitated. There's the expectation because of this pattern that this will happen again. And so Israel's bracing on its side of the wall of the fences for, you know, conflict. They've got their Iron Dome missile batteries already. They're girding for war. People on the other side, you know, some are threatening it. But even civilians are saying, you know what, like, this is getting to be too much. We need to live. We can't take this anymore. Though they're increasingly protesting Hamas itself. They're also talking now about, there's like a social media campaign to send people in mass to the fence with Israel to protest. And some, of course, are talking about, well, if we get enough protesters at the fence, maybe we just try to knock it down and head on out into Israel. So, you know, if something like that happens, it's not going to be entirely peaceful.
David Halpfinger is Jerusalem bureau chief for The New York Times. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Of the 1.9 million people in Gaza, 1.3 million are refugees. Najwa Sheikh Ahmed is one of them. She's a Palestinian refugee who has lived in Gaza her whole life. She's also the mother of five children and currently works for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in Gaza. I spoke to Najwa about what life is like for her and her family right now.
I'm currently living in the Nusayrat camp. It is one of the eight camps the refugees live in Gaza Strip. There is no work. Most of the people I know around me, even my neighbors here, doesn't have work because of the deteriorating economic situation, the social deteriorating situation also in Gaza. So the majority of the population here cannot afford food for their families. Let me say honestly that we are living but dead, actually, in the Gaza Strip. We are living and we are breathing like normal, but on the level of the psychological impact on the population here from all the circumstances that we have been through three conflicts, very extensive wars, 2008, 2012, 2014, blockade that stranded the people of the Gaza Strip. We are really feel that we are abandoned in this spot of the world, and we are like suffering from all the impact of all of these circumstances. For us, living in Gaza as a normal people, it's a matter of survival. It is really hard.
And we just spoke to a New York Times reporter who described the economic crisis in Gaza. Are you feeling that as well?
Yes, since 2006, after Hamas took over the government here in Gaza, since then, the situation is very deteriorating in terms of the economy. There is no goods going out or coming in. Many of the business and factories have been closed due to the blockade. Many of the youth who graduated from universities have no options or jobs. Gaza is considered one of the places where the unemployment rate is considered the highest in the world. There is no work. The level of poverty of the population have dramatically increased. Most of the people in Gaza dependent on welfare organizations, including UNRWA, in supporting and providing them with basic services and basic needs. As I said, there is no jobs, there is no hope among the population. And this, of course, impacted everyone, including me and my family.
And what would you say there are many, many different pieces to this and many players involved, but what would you say is maybe one of the first things that you would like to see happen to improve the situation on the ground?
In Gaza, there is almost 2 million people, including 1 million of them is refugees who are totally dependent on welfare organizations and who are totally dependent on receiving basic needs and basic services from UNRWA. The leadership, our Palestinian leadership, should work together to make the reconciliation success and to make results, positive results on the ground, on reality for the people in Gaza. The second thing, which is really important, the blockade that have been imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2006 has to be lifted. It is a shame on the international community that almost 2 million people are still living in a big prison called the Gaza Strip. So two main things, the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas should succeed, and the blockade should also be lifted.
Najwa, thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you very much.
Najwa Sheikh Ahmed is a Palestinian refugee who has lived in Gaza her whole life. She currently works for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in Gaza. Aviel Rose Richmond was 6 years old when she was shot and killed at Sandy Hook Elementary, along with 25 others. That was back in 2012. Today, Aviel's father works to end violence in his daughter's honor. Not through a campaign against guns, but rather a campaign for science and a better understanding of what violent behavior looks like in the brain. Dr. Jeremy Richmond is the founder and CEO of the Aviel Foundation, named in honor of his six-year-old daughter who was slain at Newtown. He joins me now. Dr. Richmond, thank you for being here.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
As a parent who lost a child in a school shooting, tell me, and I'm sure this is very difficult, but tell me how you felt when you heard the news of last night's horror.
Well, unfortunately, over the last 5 years, this has happened so many times. We start getting texts from friends around the country, thinking of you, we're with you, and we know something must have happened. And obviously it's a huge trigger and it breaks our hearts in a brutal way, but it also just outrages us. We feel a lot of anger and frustration with the fact that not enough is being done to prevent it.
And I can't imagine what it must feel like. Can you give us a sense after your daughter Aviel's death, how did your family cope? How did you find a way to sort of look ahead?
You know, coping is a it's a relative term. I mean, it's an infinite feeling of just brutal loss. There's a part of you missing, and immediately my wife and I, in a hazy 48 hours, decided that we were going to do something. We were going to take action, and wanted to play to our strengths. Both being scientists, we decided to approach violence from a scientific perspective and study violence as the disease that it is, coming from this organ that we know very little about, the brain, and created the foundation. And that helped a lot because it gave us a purpose, a reason, a focus, and that helped a lot.
And what can you tell our listeners what your foundation, which was named for Aviel, aimed to do?
So the mission of the Aviel Foundation is to prevent violence and build compassion through neuroscience, research, community engagement, and education. So we're actually funding basic, you know, lab bench neuroscience studies, public health studies, and clinical studies to understand what's happening under the hood up in the brain, what are the biochemical and structural factors, and what are the environmental risk factors that lead to violence, and what are the protective factors that lead away from that and toward compassion, kindness, connection, and resilience. But we also recognize that the study of violence in a vacuum is really of no value unless you can give it to the everyday person in a way that's approachable, digestible, understandable, so that they could take it home and find, in a time of crisis, a tool of value that they can apply. And we need to break down these barriers of the invisible world of mental that come with shame, trepidation, stigma, and discrimination, and move it to the tangible and understandable world of brain science so that people are willing to get help for themselves or their loved ones when there is obvious signs and symptoms of a problem.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because after this shooting, there was a lot of talk about how someone should have said something about the shooter's behavior in advance. They had, you know, noted that he was a loner. A lot of the similar narratives that we hear often about mass shooters. What can someone do in that situation? If you suspect that someone could be a danger to themselves or to others, what can someone actually do?
Well, for one thing, they can talk to, depending on the context, they can talk to the parent, they can talk to the school administration, they can talk to the law enforcement authorities, they can get police involved. If people are willing to engage and say something, then that's a start. And then we also have to train parents, teachers, healthcare providers, law enforcement, what to do when there is these reports.
And we mentioned earlier in the day, I think that Americans are just really sick of this, regardless of what side of the political divide that they stand on. And I'm thinking today about the people who've lost loved ones. Having been in that situation, what can you say to the parents and families who are going through this or other gun tragedies, who've lost loved ones in that? What message can they take from this, from you, having been through this?
Well, the people that have been through this, I think, would echo the sentiment. Thoughts and prayers are good, but they're significantly fall short. They're not enough. We have to take action. So do something. Call your political leaders, your legislators, and demand that something be done. In our case, we were sick of being reactionary. Our country has just become completely adept at reacting to violence, but we don't think of ways to prevent, intervene, or cure it. So we would encourage them to get involved, support research as an example, but do something.
Dr. Jeremy Richman is the founder and CEO of the Aviel Foundation. His daughter, Aviel Rose Richman, was killed in the Newtown shooting when she was 6 years old. Dr. Richman, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
I really appreciate the time.
No parent should ever have to fear for their sons and daughters when they kiss them goodbye in the morning. Each person who was stolen from us yesterday had a full life ahead of them, a life filled with wondrous beauty and unlimited potential and promise. Each one had dreams to pursue, love to give, and talents to share with the world. And each one had a family to whom they meant everything in the world.
We've been asking parents across the country to tell us how they're feeling today, and we've been hearing from lots of you.
I have come to the conclusion that nothing as usual will be done. We have this vicious circle of mass shootings, thoughts and prayers, social media debate, Congress does nothing, and then another mass shooting. So I decided to sit down and have a heart-to-heart talk with my middle school children. I asked if their school has an active shooter drills. Do they take them seriously? I told them that I hope and pray that they are never involved in one, to which my son replied, "Mom, I can't guarantee that we won't be involved in one, but I can guarantee I will not be the active shooter."
My name is Nicole, and I'm from Ware, New Hampshire. And yesterday, I went to my children's daycare and asked about their active shooter plan and if they've been training. We shouldn't have to do this.
Hi, this is Jose from Colorado Springs, Colorado. At the end of the day, I have to be responsible for the safety of my kids. And even if I vote and politicians don't do enough, or whether they do, at the end of the day, it all falls back on me as a parent. So I think that either security needs to be stepped up at school, or, you know, people do need to have a way to protect their own kids. And I don't think taking guns away is yet an option for this one.
My name is Rebecca, and I'm calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. This morning when I was taking my son to school, right away, the first subject was what happened in Parkland yesterday. And he said, "I don't want to talk about it," but the fear in his voice this morning was a lot to take. And I have another child that is about to go to high school next year, and this is very difficult to try to make a decision. Do we homeschool? Do we keep them to try to enjoy the rest of their school years? We shouldn't be having to go through this.
Jenny on Facebook tells us, quote, "My son is about to start kindergarten and the school classrooms have half walls made of drywall and no doors. I'm seriously considering moving to another school or homeschooling because of the safety issues." Parents and students, how are you feeling today? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. It's one of the most anticipated movies of the year, so much so that at a recent Black comic book festival in New York City, it's all anyone wanted to talk about.
Black Panther.
When I saw the trailer, it moved me.
I want to know more about where he comes from and why, how did he become the king of Wakanda?
I didn't find out about Black Panther until like later in life. And then when I found out about him, I was just like, Batman who? Iron Man who? Superman who?
Growing up looking at a lot of superheroes, really only had Black Panther and Storm for the most part.
Black Panther in the mainstream, finally.
It makes me think that I could be anything that I want.
We're all meeting and going together as a group to watch it.
Me, I'm a fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates and Roxanne Gay, who I know are writing the Black Panther series.
I just really, really want to see it because that's my favorite character.
You might have caught a mention in there of a name that could be familiar to some of you.
My name is Roxanne Gay, and I'm the writer of World of Wakanda for Marvel Comics. It is a comic series set in the Black Panther universe and focuses on the Dora Milaje, the elite women's guard that protects Black Panther, the royal family, and ultimately Wakanda.
Roxanne Gay is the author behind books including Difficult Women and Hunger, but now she's deeply immersed herself in the universe of Black Panther. Though, as she told me, she hasn't been a lifelong comics fan, and the same goes for me, actually. I grew up reading Archie comics, and that was about it.
I'm actually an Archie comics girl, too. That's what I grew up reading. And it wasn't until I got this opportunity to write World of Wakanda that I began to read contemporary comics. And it was really wonderful to see what's happening in the world of comics right now And I was surprised by the opportunity, but I really enjoyed it as well.
So out of being a writer, how does writing for superheroes and for their fans compare to other types of writing you've done?
It's a lot more collaborative than a lot of the other writing I've done because you're working with artists and inkers and editors and so many other people that get to contribute to interpreting your vision. So that is really different and really interesting.
And the series was originally created by two white men, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, in 1966. Would you say that with this interpretation of it, that Black creators have fully regained ownership of Black Panther's world?
Yeah, definitely, because Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing Black Panther right now, and I wrote World of Wakanda. Rembert Brown also contributed, Yona Harvey. Right now, I think it's only Black people working on World of Wakanda, and it's wonderful that we get to do that.
You know, in a lot of ways, as I'm sure you know, Marvel has been on the front lines, I think, of experimenting on the page in terms of the diversity of its characters. So they had an Afro-Latino Spider-Man, they had a Muslim Miss Marvel, but then they canceled this series after just a couple of issues. What's up with that?
You know, World of Wakanda was always going to be 6 issues. Nonetheless, it's disappointing that they have not continued the series because I would have loved to continue working or just to see anyone continuing these characters and their journey. I think that Marvel is good about inviting people of color into the universe, but they are not good at retention. And that's because they don't know how to market to our communities as well. Right now, they don't really do much in terms of outreach beyond their core audience. And that's a shame because a lot of us have core audiences who simply don't know where to get comics or how the comic system works. And also, it's kind of cost prohibitive. They come out every single week, and each issue is around $3.99, which is a lot when you're buying multiple comics. So I think there are a lot of factors at play, you know, and I think sometimes certain stories take time to build and we have to be given that time. And unfortunately, we are not yet given that time. We're just given like one opportunity. And if you're not wildly successful, you're out of there.
In terms of the connection between this and the film, some of your characters made it into the film, didn't they?
Yes, they did. But the characters, Io and Anika, they were in the Marvel Universe already. In my world of Wakanda, Anika is a captain in the Dora Milaje, and Io is a young upstart who comes and challenges Anika's authority. Every year, 18 women, one from each of the 18 tribes of Wakanda, come to the capital, the Golden City, and they train to join this elite guard. And from the beginning, Io is rebellious, and Anika is trying to humble her as she trains her to become a member of this fighting guard. And eventually they fall in love. And they also realize that they need to do more than just serve the King of Wakanda. They need to serve the entire country because Black Panther is being distracted by things that are happening abroad and within his own country. And so they decide to start protecting the people of Wakanda as best they can.
Do you think that your contribution to this series was in some way sort of reaching out to Black women who I don't think see themselves reflected in comics very often, if at all?
I really hope so. That's one of the many reasons I do what I do, is because representation and inclusion are really important. And I want Black women of all ages to see ourselves doing heroic things, to see ourselves having healthy and loving relationships. And World of Wakanda was an opportunity to have that happen in a very visible way.
And what types of stories do you think are missing from the superhero world today? I mean, we talked a little bit about representation and marketing, but are there stories that you think haven't even shown up on the radar that should be focused on?
I think we need more queer stories. I think we need more stories that show not only the action, but the struggles that heroes have. You know, I understand the idea of the hero, the idea of the people who do the things that we cannot or that we dare not do. But I think it's useful to show heroes that are human and that have doubts and that have fears, but that also are generally happy and healthy. So not as morose as Batman, who's an unhappy billionaire. I mean, come on.
He is. No, I know. It's a bit much. And if you could create a superhero, your own superhero, do you have any ideas on what that might be or what that person might sound like or look like?
I think she would be a Black woman who would be, you know, really smart and really kind, probably a little shy, but not when it matters most. She would be human, though. I think oftentimes we expect heroes to be perfect, and I'm not interested in writing perfect heroes. I'm interested in writing interesting heroes.
On that note, I'm going to close it out because I think you're a well-rounded hero to so many women out there. So I really appreciate you being with us today, Roxanne.
Thank you so much, Tanzina. I appreciate that.
Roxanne Gay is the author of Difficult Women, Hunger, and Black Panther, World of Wakanda. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.